Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Criminal Law and Procedure Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, April 17, 2014, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call. Today, our topic is sentencing in criminal cases. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're going to hear from two experts today, as usual, with only a brief introduction so we can get right to the substance. We're going to hear first from Professor Douglas Berman. He's the Robert J. Watkins Procter & Gamble Professor of Law at the Ohio State University Moritz College of Law. He'll be followed in his opening remarks by the Honorable Professor Paul G. Cassell. He's the Ronald N. Boyce Presidential Endowed Chair in Criminal Law at the University of Utah College of Law. They're going to give us opening remarks each of about 5 to 10 minutes, and then we'll encourage some back and forth discussion between the two of them, and then we'll come to you for your questions. So please do be ready with your questions. And with that, Professor Berman, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, and thank you to the Federalist Society and everybody involved in putting this together, and those listening on the phone to talk about what I think has to be a very complicated and intricate issue. And I'm grateful to share the line with Professor Cassell, because I'm sure he agrees with me that this is a complicated and challenging issue, but we have slightly different takes on how we think it should be resolved. The jumping off point for a discussion of what I tend to call acquitted conduct and its use at sentencing is a recent decision by the D.C. Circuit Court affirming a sentence for a drug defendant, Antoine Ball, that significantly enhanced the sentence he otherwise would have received based on the judge's consideration of what I am calling acquitted conduct. And just to provide a little background, hopefully quickly, about the case, that will, among other things, allow us to discuss more generally the use of acquitted conduct at sentencing in the federal system. Mr. Ball was accused and was thought to be part by the government of a very large drug conspiracy where, among other things claimed by the government in its indictment, Mr. Ball was involved through the conspiracy in a massive amount of racketeering, a massive amount of drug dealing, and even some murder charges. Mr. Ball, among a number of defendants, denied a number of those charges, went to trial. At the trial, which took place all the way back in 2007, Mr. Ball was acquitted on every count brought in that indictment, save for one crack distribution count relating to a $600 half-ounce hand-to-hand sale of crack cocaine, which itself dated all the way back to 2001. A long story short in terms of how things proceeded after there, but the prosecutors, believing, perhaps, I'm sure, in complete good faith, that the jury got it wrong, that, in fact, Mr. Ball was guilty of being part of this massive drug conspiracy, had a role in homicides that were related to that conspiracy, went to the sentencing on that one count of conviction and asked the judge to impose a maximum statutory sentence of 40 years on the crack charge. And just as a basic part of that story, the crack charge alone only justified, under statutes passed by Congress, a sentence ranging from 5 to 40 years, and the government relying heavily on all their claims that Mr. Ball was as bad a guy as they had alleged at the outset, deserved the maximum sentence of 40 years. Interestingly, just to fit in here how the federal sentencing guidelines operate and play a role, based on just the hand-to-hand crack sale alone, Mr. Ball's guideline range would have been, as I understand it, in the neighborhood of 51 to 71 months. So just to sort of ballpark that, based on the guidelines recommendation for the offense for which he was convicted, it called for about a 5-year sentence, again, remembering the government asking for 40, though one of the reasons the government's asking for 40 is because they pointed to what's known as relevant conduct, that is, information related to the offense of conviction, not that was the basis of a conviction, and sometimes it can be uncharged conduct that the government can point to. But in this case, because Mr. Ball had gone to trial and been acquitted, I want to give it the label acquitted conduct. The government pointed to all of that conduct, said to the judge, we believe we established by a preponderance of the evidence, the standard civil standard for judges making findings or juries making findings in civil cases, that in fact Mr. Ball did all these things. And because of that, the right calculation of his range should be not 51 to 71 months, but instead 292 to 365 months, or just to, again, ballpark it now, somewhere in the neighborhood of 25 to 30 years. And so based on acquitted conduct, part one of this story of Mr. Ball's sentencing is instead of the official guideline rules, which importantly now are only advisory, recommending the judge impose a sentence of around 5 years, the acquitted conduct operated to enhance the guideline recommended sentence fivefold, roughly speaking, to about 25 years or longer. Interestingly, the district judge at sentencing didn't rely on a preponderance standard, actually described his findings in terms of clear and convincing evidence, and at the sentencing of Mr. Ball, he said, quote, that he saw clear evidence of a drug conspiracy as part of the conviction that the 2001 hand-to-hand crack transaction involved, and so said the proper guideline calculation was in the range of 292 to 365 months, although interestingly then used his discretion to vary down from that range and ultimately impose a sentence of roughly speaking about 19 years on Mr. Ball. That then got appealed to the D.C. Circuit, and one of the focal points of the appeal, a point that I've been concerned about for quite some time, was that this sentence was only justifiable if and when the judge relied, as on this record it was clear that he did, on conduct for which Mr. Ball had been acquitted by a jury. And to me, that's the issue most of concern that I am, in fact, planning to help write an amicus brief to try to get the Supreme Court's attention on. About 15 years ago, the Supreme Court blessed in a general matter constitutionally the permissibility of judges relying on acquitted conduct in this way to enhance a sentence, but that was done in a per curiam kind of back-of-the-hand way and has not been able to be updated or reconsidered in light of some recent Supreme Court jurisprudence about sentencing relating to the Sixth Amendment and the importance of jury findings, even more broadly about the reformulation of the federal sentencing system in light of those Sixth Amendment concerns. And this is a very long-winded way of saying I think I am not misguided in believing there is something to be concerned about when a defendant exercises his constitutional right to go to trial, prevails as a result of putting the government to its burden of proof, and then the government has the opportunity to get a second bite at the apple in front of the judge, and in fact does secure a sentence that is, depending on how you want to calculate it, four or five times longer by virtue of the judge's reliance on conduct which the jury concluded through its verdict they thought the defendant should not be held responsible for. And so that's where I get started, and as I mentioned, I'm already working with the lawyer and some others to try to write an amicus brief that will encourage the Supreme Court to take this issue up anew. But one of the challenges we're facing is every circuit through the years, in the wake of the Supreme Court's, in my view, cursory treatment of this issue almost two decades ago, has said, well, the law of the land is that you can consider acquitted conduct, and we're going to keep affirming sentences that are based expressly and directly and involve quite significant increases in the guideline range and in the ultimate sentence imposed because a judge has, I won't say disagreed with the jury verdict, has concluded based on applicable law that there's enough evidence to justify a significant sentence increase based on the evidence the government put forward, but evidence that was insufficient to convince a jury to convict. And with that, I will hopefully have led Professor Casale to think I've laid the issue out and laid out my concerns enough, and then see if he views it different ways or if my description is less than perfectly accurate, and then we can go back and forth to see if this is as big a problem as I think it is and as I think the Supreme Court ought to think it is.
This is Professor Casale, and it's great to be on the line with my friend, Professor Berman. I think everyone listening to this podcast may be aware that Professor Berman runs what is truly an indispensable blog, the Sentencing Law and Policy blog, for anyone who's interested in these sentencing issues. So I look forward to seeing what he says about this issue on the blog and in his amicus brief. I do agree it's an important issue, although I have to say that I'm not particularly convinced that it's a challenging issue, at least under the sentencing regimes that we have in this country nowadays. The issue of acquitted conduct, I think Professor Berman has very accurately set up the case and described the Antoine Ball case. Basically, let's remember what we're looking at. We're looking at a situation where Ball was convicted of one distribution count, and everyone agrees that that exposed him to a sentence of 5 to 40 years in prison. So the issue we're debating today is where within that 5 to 40 years should Ball have gone, and what sort of power should the judge, the sentencing judge, have in crafting that particular sentence. Now, there's one answer that could be given to that question. That would be to turn to the sentencing guidelines and say that the sentencing guidelines dictate where within that very broad 5 to 40 year range a sentence ought to be imposed. But, of course, to the applause of Professor Berman and many defense advocates, in the Booker decision, the Supreme Court said that those guidelines could not be binding. And so Professor Berman mentions the 51 to 71-month guideline range that the defense attorneys in this case calculated, excluding the acquitted conduct. One answer would be to say, well, that he ought to get something within the 51 to 71 months unless there's a very good reason for imposing a different sentence. The Supreme Court, of course, in Booker said that's the wrong way to look at it. The sentencing guidelines are advisory. And the whole reason that they gave for advisory guidelines was that the judges should have discretion to determine what the appropriate sentence is after looking at all of the factors. And so I think one of the important background principles here is we are now working in a sentencing regime in which judges are supposed to craft an appropriate sentence and look at all of the factors. And indeed, I think Professor Berman will be referring to this Alline case that was decided last year. Just one quote from that case. The Supreme Court said, broad judicial discretion informed by judicial fact-finding does not violate the Sixth Amendment. And so that's essentially what we're looking at here. The judge in this case, Judge Roberts, who I think is a very well-regarded district court judge, certainly not one who's inclined to automatically side with the prosecutor, decided that in this particular case, the appropriate sentence was, as Doug said, 18 or 19 years. The question would be, should that determination have somehow exempted the acquitted conduct? That is, the fact that should the judge have ignored all the information that the jury apparently found insufficient to establish a conspiracy at trial in determining a sentence. Now, I think where Doug and I part company is on Doug's view that the government is getting a second bite at the apple, I think was his phrase, when the judge started to look at this conduct. I don't think that's quite right. I think we have different stages in the process. At the trial, the jury has to find whether or not a defendant has been proven guilty beyond any reasonable doubt. For those who have a sort of numerical mind on these kinds of issues, I think one way of putting that would be the government has to show by 99.99% proof that a particular point has been established. And, of course, that's a very high standard of proof, and that's quite appropriate when the issue is whether or not to convict someone of a crime. But when we move to sentencing, historically the burden of proof has only been preponderance of the evidence, 51%, if you will. And that approach has long been agreed to be the appropriate standard at sentencing. And as a result, I think the Supreme Court has very clearly spoken that there is no problem in considering acquitted conduct. Professor Berman mentions that the Supreme Court blessed in a general manner the use of acquitted conduct. I guess it is true that that's a per curiam opinion, but it was a very strong opinion, an 8-1 decision. Dissenting was only Justice Souter, who is no longer on the court. That's United States versus Watts, and I think it's important to talk about what Watts said. Watts said, under a federal statute, 18 U.S. Code 3661, there is, quote, no limit, close quote, on the information a judge can consider at sentencing. And, of course, in many situations, that broad power for a sentencing judge redounds to the benefit of a criminal defendant. Defendants can argue that they were an Eagle Boy Scout or that they saved a dog from drowning in the river or a variety of different things that may or may not, strictly speaking, be relevant. but they're allowed to make those arguments. But so too can prosecutors point to a broad range of things. For example, one of the cases that Watts relied on is a case that I know Professor Berman spends a great deal of time talking about in his sentencing class, Williams versus New York. In that case, prosecutors pointed to 30 unconvicted burglaries as one reason to give that defendant, Williams, a longer sentence than he would otherwise have received. The basic point that the Watts decision made was that a jury makes no finding that a defendant is somehow innocent of acquitted conduct. It only concludes that the government has failed to meet its burden of proof. And then when we get to the lower burden of proof that's associated with sentencing, there's nothing wrong with a judge like Judge Roberts looking at the facts and deciding that those facts that the government thought could prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt should be part of the sentencing calculation. Now, let me raise just one question, and maybe Doug and I will have a chance now to start going back and forth on this just a little bit. I'm really interested to see how Professor Berman would structure the rule that he seems to support. So I guess he would say that acquitted conduct could not be considered. But what would that mean in the context of this case? The jury acquitted Ball of a conspiracy charge, maybe concluding that he didn't conspire with others. But there were certainly very strong evidence that Ball had done a number of individual acts that were part of the conspiracy count at some level, but I think could be considered to enhance his sentence. Let's see, just to give a couple of examples, there was testimony that what Ball says goes on the street. Ball had done so much more than just selling 11 grams of crack, had done so much more than that both before and after, said Judge Roberts. Despite having seen how crack addiction ravaged his own family, he'd chosen at an adult age to lead a conspiracy and to spread the same poison on the street. He sold crack, he stole crack, he pistol-whipped a guy, he pressured teenage girls not to tell anyone about a murder. Which of those facts would the court have to turn a blind eye to when sentencing Ball, and which ones of those facts would the judge be able to use? I think that's a very difficult question for Professor Berman to answer, but obviously I look forward to hearing what he has to say.
Well, I agree, and I will try to answer it as effectively as possible, though I want to push back a little bit on the framing that Professor Cassell, understandably, and I think to a large extent rightly, starts with, which is if we think, as I do, that judges ought to have relatively broad discretion to consider a range of facts and factors at sentencing, some that will help the defendant because they're mitigating, some that will potentially harm the defendant because they're aggravating. Am I pushing against that when expressing concern about judicial consideration of so-called acquitted conduct facts? And the answer is I kind of am. Now, I want to then layer that out a little bit more. First is, Professor Cassell rightly pointed to, there is a federal statute, a statute that the Supreme Court relied on heavily in Watts, that suggests Congress wants judges to be considering as much information as they can in order to inform their discretion at sentencing. And I'm not, and I hope everybody understands that I'm not arguing against that basic concept that I think is an important and valuable one, and that finds expression now in a more hearty way, given that the federal sentencing guidelines are advisory. But what my concern that really is what drives acquitted conduct, and this will be a long-winded way of answering the hard question that Professor Cassell has put to me, is not about either a limit or an opportunity for judges to consider material at sentencing. It actually is about the way in which it ends up incentivizing and structuring how prosecutors are going to approach cases like Mr. Ball, like so many other cases, because I do think it's accurate to suggest that it provides a second bite at the apple and a dangerous one at that. In fact, I think if I provide the right context, I can start to explain why it provides a third bite at the apple of sorts for prosecutors to benefit from acquitted conduct enhancements, and why that can be uniquely pernicious in a case like Mr. Ball's and in some others as well. Let me try to explain. First and foremost, prosecutors have, federal prosecutors in particular in this case, but state prosecutors as well, incredibly broad charging and bargaining discretion. And though we could debate, and maybe we should debate, broader concerns about overcharging or undercharging or the way in which prosecutors at the state and federal level use their discretion to decline certain cases for certain reasons and to prosecute other cases for other reasons, the simple story is not only is that something that's fully within the prosecutor's prerogative, but it's not subject to any regulation or any transparency, any review. It is, for a variety of both sensible and I think sometimes not so sensible reasons, completely in the executive branch's bailiwick to decide how to process cases based on how they're brought to them and how they want to structure their own priorities and decision making. But what the operation of that power create, especially when combined, as happens a lot in the federal system, sometimes in state systems as well, is that it combines with mandatory minimum sentencing regimes or sometimes other mandates or advice built into guideline systems that mean prosecutors have an incentive, dangerously perhaps too much of an incentive, to overcharge in order to create significant plea bargaining leverage. And my guess would be, and again, I'm not suggesting this is an inappropriate prosecutorial decision, but that one of the reasons Mr. Ball was charged with so many crimes as part of this massive drug conspiracy, including homicide allegations and a range of others, was those additional charges carried with them not just the mandatory minimum of 5 years that the crack conviction carried, but in some cases as much as a mandatory minimum of life imprisonment. And my guess would be, Professor Casale and I were both involved in different ways in a case where this was a somewhat parallel type of situation, that after bringing an indictment with all these charges that carried all sorts of mandatory prison time, were there a full range of convictions, that either the prosecutors went to Mr. Ball or at the very least a competent defense attorney, upon seeing this indictment, went to Mr. Ball and said, look, these charges are so serious, and the government has some pretty good evidence. In fact, they wouldn't bring these charges if they didn't have some pretty good evidence. And if you're convicted, even on many of these charges, let alone all of them, in all likelihood, you will have to get, if not a life sentence, that the recommended sentence will mean you will never step out of a prison cell ever again in your life. And I'm only speculating what Mr. Ball might have said in response to this, but I don't think it's wrong to make this speculation in light of what the jury's found. Mr. Ball may have said, but I'm not guilty of that. Or at the very least, whatever the government is alleging is not completely accurate, and I don't believe they can lawfully, based on the standards that we've enshrined in our constitutional jurisprudence, prove that I am guilty of all of those terrible things that they're saying I'm guilty of. And I know I have a right to test their evidence at trial, and I want to test their evidence at trial. If and when Mr. Ball said such a thing, and I hope we would all see that as a virtuous response if he genuinely believed that he wasn't guilty of many of the acts the government claimed he did, his defense attorney, to be wise and sensible, would have said, that's all well and good, Mr. Ball, but odds are the government doesn't bring this case unless they're very confident they're going to win. And odds are, even if you have every reason to believe you're not guilty and that you at the very least could raise a reasonable doubt in front of a jury, you're likely to get convicted. And once you're convicted, it's virtually a certainty that the government will recommend and succeed in getting a judge to conclude that you should be either mandatorily or discretionarily sentenced to 30, 40, 50, maybe life without the possibility of parole. And so as innocent as you may be, and this is true not just for Mr. Ball, this is true for a heck of a lot of other defendants facing similar situations, especially when there's wide-ranging allegations of lots of different kinds of criminality, which is, of course, most of the federal docket when we're talking about drug conspiracies, gun issues, and or white-collar offenses of any substantial size. Your only hope of never being, your only realistic hope of never of ever seeing outside of the prison walls again, Mr. Ball, will be to plead guilty, even if that involves pleading guilty to things you believe you're not guilty of. Because by virtue of pleading guilty, the government would agree to a lesser sentence. They may agree to dismiss some of the more far-fetched charges they have against you because they themselves may know they can't prove it all the way up to a jury. And if you agree, hear their offering. I don't know the specifics of this case, but my guess would be, in light of what they allege Mr. Ball to have done, they'll offer that you only have to serve 30 years, and you're a relatively young man. You're in your mid-20s. You know, that means at least you'll get to spend your golden years outside of the prison walls. And Mr. Ball may have said in response, I appreciate your advice, but I didn't do this, and because I didn't do anything other than a small-level crack sale, or at least, and again, maybe this gets too sophisticated, maybe I bullied some women, maybe I was a bully in the neighborhood, maybe I was involved in some other crack activities as well, but all these other things they're claiming I did that would lead me to be subject to decades of imprisonment are just not true. And I understand the odds of my being acquitted may be very slim, and the government's going to use all their resources to have me convicted. But to me, what makes this country great, Mr. Ball might be saying, although I'd be surprised if as eloquently as I'm trying to say it here, is I can test the government's proof by going to a trial and having a group of peers judge in their mind's eye whether or not they think I am guilty under our legal standards of all of this stuff that's being alleged against me. And that's what Mr. Ball chose to do. And my guess would be his attorney probably recommended repeatedly that that might not be a wise decision, though I assume the reason that advice was given was be careful. If you get convicted, your judge is going to have to sentence you essentially the rest of your life in prison. What ends up happening at trial when Mr. Ball makes that choice? He ends up prevailing, and that itself is an exceptional reality, right? The reality is very few federal criminal cases go to trial, in part because the government usually has very good proof, and in part because competent defense attorneys tell defendants in cases like Mr. Ball's case that it's very long odds to get an acquittal. But what acquitted conduct leads to, because this is really what the rest of the advice would need to be, given the Watts decision, given the way the guidelines structure the use of acquitted conduct, even if you do prevail, Mr. Ball, in getting the jury to acquit you of every other count, just that low-level drug sale will be the hook that the court can use, the hook, problematically, that the guidelines encourage the court to use to consider everything the government has alleged, even that material with which you've been acquitted. So even after the jury rejects the government's allegations, and what's notable about the Antoine Ball case, this got coverage in the local D.C. papers, is when the government went to the judge at sentencing and says, we still think he's guilty of all of this, the judge took some time and it got some press attention, and some members of the jury actually wrote to the judge expressing how aghast they were that they had spent 2 months considering in detail all the evidence in this case and had concluded, not just they claimed beyond a reasonable doubt, against the government that they couldn't prove it that much, but they just thought there wasn't even decent evidence the government had put forward that Mr. Ball was involved in this broader conspiracy with all of this other untoward allegations that the government brought against him. And so the jury was expressing its concern, I think quite understandable, and I think quite problematic in light of our commitment to the importance of citizen service through a jury, that their voice in this process was being drowned out by prosecutors who wanted their third bite at the apple, right? The third bite, the first bite is they do the indictment, and they put some of the evidence in front of a grand jury, and because of that, this incredible indictment leads a sensible defense attorney to tell Mr. Ball he would be, in some sense, foolish or, at the very least, taking an incredibly risky path to even put the government to its burden of proof. Mr. Ball decides, has the courage or the wisdom or the insight to know that the proof isn't that great that the government is alleging, and so he puts the government to that burden of proof. And a jury, just like Mr. Ball did earlier, agrees and rejects the government's claim that Mr. Ball is to be lawfully convicted for these allegations. But now, third time's the charm for the government, all they have to do is suggest to a judge. And again, not suggest to a judge that the evidence is good, just that the evidence is more convincing than not. And of course, throughout all of this, Mr. Ball has, for a variety of strategic or practical reasons, been unable or unwilling to put a full defense because we think, though maybe this isn't what we think should be happening, and maybe I think this is my pushback to Professor Cassell, that it should be Ball's obligation to disprove the government's allegations now that he's been convicted of one count. And that's where I sort of come back to. To me, what's most fundamentally important and in some sense most fundamentally worrisome about acquitted conduct enhancements is the fact that if and when a government indicts on all of this material, they already have the chance to, I don't want to say bully, but encourage a defendant to admit guilt, even if they don't have proof beyond a reasonable doubt, even if all it is the threat that there's a possibility that a jury will be convinced enough when a prominent government official gets up and says, we think this guy did that, and that the defendant is in a difficult position, though he does have the benefit of the beyond a reasonable doubt burden of proof, to question the government's proof. If a defendant has the courage and insight to say, I don't think the government's going to be able to convince a jury at the level we think is important, the government gets the chance to try to do that. And again, assuming at that point now we're gearing up for trial, the government's going to throw everything in their disposal at the jury to try to get a conviction on that count. In so doing, the judge is sitting there getting to weigh that evidence, but presumably it shouldn't be his job, and I hope it isn't his job, to be serving as a separate jury, asking himself, well, yeah, the jury is going to decide on beyond a reasonable doubt, but I'll look at that evidence and try to figure out for myself whether I think this defendant is really guilty, because I'm going to be sentencing him for something down the line, and I want to hold him fully accountable for what I think he did, regardless of what the jury ultimately returns with. And that's the problem we get to, is that's fundamentally what the prosecutor is in a position to ask for as a result of allowing acquitted conduct enhancement. And what I want to suggest, and again, it's what is challenging practically, but I don't think all that challenging when you get to cases like Mr. Ball's, is any information that was central to the indictment brought against Mr. Ball and that was central to any of the charges with which the jury acquitted, it is the judge's obligation, and now this gets very nuanced, not to consider that in calculating the guideline range. I mentioned this in my lead-up. I would be very comfortable if the judge had relied on a guideline range of 51 to 71 months and then said, but this isn't a standard crack dealer with a low-level crack. This person, I believe, is a much more aggravated character for a variety of reasons, which I'll lay out on the record, none of which attend to material or information that the jury has expressly concluded should not be the basis of additional punishment through an additional conviction. But what the government was able to do, what the judge is duty-bound, even in an advisory guideline system, to do, was calculate the guideline range incorporating the acquitted conduct if he was convinced by a preponderance of the evidence that that which the jury rejected he still thought was more likely true than not. Again, I mentioned it's a civil standard because we associate it with only moving money around, which is what we do in our civil system, not with the deprivation of liberty, our criminal justice system, where we have this constitutional standard of proof beyond a reasonable doubt. But for a judge in this case, not just in the ultimate sentencing determination, but in calculating the benchmark guideline range, the judge is asked to, duty-bound and required to, consider anything the government throws its way under the guidelines that the judge finds more plausible than not. And that's what he did in order to enhance the range from, roughly speaking, 5 years all the way up to 25 years. And then the judge felt, framed that way, that he was giving Mr. Ball a break by coming down to about 19 years. But for me, that's exactly backwards. What it should be is, the framing is, based on his offensive conviction, he should get 5 years. Judge, if you think he's worse than that, go explain, and you, judge, have the burden to establish on the record all the reasons why you think 5 years isn't enough in light of what has been satisfactorily proven in our courts. Not, oh, the prosecution has convinced me, a government official, but not a juror, that this is close enough for government work, so therefore I start with a 25-year range, and then I give him a little bit of a rake, and he only gets 19, and what's the big deal? I'm just exercising my discretion. As that all plays out, what I think is really going on is he's catering to a prosecutorial desire to even win when they lose. And that, I think, is not only dangerous for the Mr. Balls of the world, it's dangerous for all the rest of us, because it means prosecutors get three chances to take whatever they're convinced of and have us suffer the consequences of it, even if the defendant rightly agrees that they can't prove it beyond a reasonable doubt, even if a jury rejects the government's claim of proof beyond a reasonable doubt, as long as a single other government official thinks it's good enough for government work, we then reframe it and put the burden on Mr. Ball, put the burden on the rest of us now to prove our innocence, to avoid the extra punishment, rather than to just raise questions about the government's claims of guilt.
Okay. Professor Cassell, I want to give you a chance to rejoin here.
Sure. Let me just respond to a few things, and then we may have some questions from our listeners out there. It's, I think, a curious debate that we're having today because, in general, I would prefer a world in which judges have less discretion. I would prefer a world in which Booker had come out the other way and the guidelines really did have some teeth. But I know that Doug likes the world in which Booker was decided, and judges then have considerable discretion. But I think it's important to understand he then concedes that he's moving from that general view of the world, that discretion is a good thing, and thinks that this particular exercise of discretion is somehow inappropriate. And I want to push him on that because I'm not really sure that that squares with his general view. He talks about the defendant's right to test the government's evidence, and he uses, of course, language that defense attorneys like to use, that this was a threat that the government would do these sorts of things. I think it's always important to remember that Antoine Ball made the initial choice to distribute crack cocaine in a community where that offense has very serious consequences. And even though he was only convicted of one count, at that point the sentencing range was 5 to 40 years. So the government wasn't threatening him with anything other than the fact that he could be looking at a sentence that was close to the maximum, a 40-year prison sentence. In fact, he got something that was only under half of that maximum. And I think that's quite consistent with the fact, as I think Doug is conceding, that we have a federal statute which says specifically that no limit can be imposed on what a judge considers at sentencing. Now, Doug makes the point that, well, look, some of the jury members felt like they had rejected some of these claims and so forth, and that they'd spent 2 months working on this, listening to all the evidence. I don't know that that's quite right. The jury spent 2 months trying to decide whether or not Antoine Ball was guilty beyond a reasonable doubt of the charges. It'd be interesting to see what the jury would have found if they were told, well, you could find he's a member of a conspiracy, but you need only do so by a preponderance of the evidence. If we're really worried about the jury's voice being drowned out, my understanding is that we could go across the state line into Virginia and find a sentencing scheme in which jurors do impose sentencing. At least I think there have been some cases historically where that's been the case. However, defense attorneys are not, as I understand it, big fans of jury sentencing, at least down in Virginia and places where it's been tried, because juries oftentimes impose longer sentences than would judges. So we can certainly find ways in which juries could have a greater voice in the process, but I'm not sure if that would necessarily be a good thing for criminal defendants, or more generally a good thing for the system, because juries may have idiosyncratic views on the severity of a particular case or the utility of a mitigating factor. So Doug says, look, what we ought to be doing here is at least change the way guideline ranges are calculated in these kinds of cases. You notice he's got some fudge factors, though, in the middle of his proposal. He said that any information that was central to the charges should not be considered in calculating the guideline ranges. Of course, that would spawn a whole new sentencing jurisprudence about was and was not central to a particular charge. Not really sure that that's what we need to introduce greater complexity into what is already a very complicated sentencing regime. Doug, the larger point, though, is why would we want to exclude evidence that was central to the conspiracy charge, for example, in this case? We know from the jury's verdict that the government could not prove that that, in fact, had occurred by a standard of proof that, let's say, is 99.99%. But in this case, the judge found that the evidence was clear that Antoine Ball was running a drug conspiracy. Let's say that's 95% likely to be accurate. Why would we want to exclude evidence that's 95% likely to be accurate from the sentencing calculation that goes into the guidelines? I'm not really convinced that Professor Berman has provided a good answer to that, other than to say that, well, maybe we need higher standards of proof at sentencing. But one of the
things, I guess I will retort to that and then open up to questions is, if it was that high of proof, I presume Antoine Ball would have been smart enough, and his defense attorney likewise would have been smart enough to say, you're an idiot for thinking you could get a jury to acquit you when there's 95% proof chance that you're actually involved in a conspiracy, and he likely would have pled guilty to that charge. In addition, if in fact that's what was going on, I don't think the prosecutors would have failed to establish proof beyond a reasonable doubt, because speaking of fudge factors, you're now have elevated what the judge would have to find from 51% to 95%, and I guess that's where I'm saying the uncertainty lies. If we are comfortable with the system in which, as long as the third set of individuals the prosecution's trying to convince, presumably they tried to convince the defense attorney and the defendant, it's in his best interest to plead guilty. Presumably they tried to convince the jury, independent observers, that there was proof at a high threshold, the threshold that, again, we think is constitutionally essential to protect liberty and innocence in our constitutional balances. After they failed on both those fronts, I share your sense that if it's so obvious to a judge, it may be painful for him to be forced to close his eyes to it. But I'm not suggesting he has to close his eyes to it. I'm just suggesting that it ought not be central to setting the framing and benchmark for where the judge starts his individualized consideration, which is how the guidelines now function and operate. And that's itself where, feeding it all the way back, it's especially pernicious in facilitating prosecutors bringing every charge, knowing they're going to get three bites at the apple, and in all likelihood that third bite will be the easiest one of all. And that's exactly what ended up leading Antoine Ball to be subject to a 20-year sentence, rather than what I think is more fitting in light of what the jury found and what he himself claimed, which would have been somewhere in the range of maybe 5 to 10. Now, again, maybe I'm wrong to worry that all of our liberty is at stake when prosecutors are given that much power. Maybe I'm wrong to think that this one kind of limit on judicial sentencing discretion actually serves a broader set of procedural values. But to me, what really bothers me is that so many lower courts are so quick to say, there's nothing to see here. There's nothing to be worried about. There's nothing we need to really see as part of a broader set of issues other than a judge having authority to send a crack dealer to prison for as long as he thinks is appropriate. And that's where I blog about this case and invest my amicus time and energy, because I think there are bigger issues at stake that go to the relationship between a government and its people. And that's why I'm, again, ecstatic that we've had a chance to go back and forth on this, and perhaps at this point eager to hear if some of the listeners have different perspectives than either Professor Cassell and I have shared.
Professor Cassell, were you finished? Can we go to questions from the audience?
Sure, we can. I'd be glad to take questions from the audience. Just one last point, though. It'll be interesting to see if the Supreme Court reviews the petition. Doug alluded to the fact that lower courts have been quick to dismiss the argument that he's advancing. In fact, by my count, the circuit vote is now 12 in favor of my position, 0 in favor of the contrary position. And so it's going to be a difficult proposition, I think, to have the Supreme Court take this case and review it, simply because there's been so much unanimity among other judges that have looked at the question and found no problem with it at all.
All right, let's now go to the audience for their questions. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for either of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got two callers with questions at this point. Let's take our first call.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. Someone undertaking to brief this issue should probably examine an important case that was appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court and a precedent established. That was the case, appropriately, because of the anniversary coming up, of the surviving Davidians. You recall the events at Waco, near Waco, 21 years ago. In the trial, the surviving Davidians were charged with several crimes. They were also charged with an enhancement of carrying a weapon during the commission of a crime. The jury found that they were acting in self-defense, that therefore the only crime committed was on the part of the federal agents, but that there may have also been a crime committed by other Davidians, some of the dead ones, but not by the ones who were actually carrying the weapons. They found that they were carrying the weapons during the commission of a crime, without specifying who committed the crime. The defense moved to dismiss the remaining conviction, and the judge agreed, saying that one can't be guilty of an enhancement if one is not guilty of the underlying crime. But then the prosecution demanded and got an ex parte conference with the judge, after which he came out, reversed his previous ruling, imposed a heavy sentence, and when the defense objected, explained, quote, "the law doesn't have to be logical," unquote. This was appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, which reduced some of the sentences, but did not reverse the conviction of an enhancement without the predicate of the underlying crime. So if you're going to brief this subject, you're going to be up against this precedent.
I appreciate hearing about that, and I will definitely both advise Mr. Ball's attorney to look into it, and I will myself.
I think the case involved whether or not a machine gun could be viewed as a sentencing factor that could be determined by the judge, or was a element of the offense that had to be determined by the jury. And under the statutory scheme, the court concluded, as it has done in a number of cases, Booker and some of the more recent ones, that this was essentially an element of the offense that the jury had to look at. So I'm not sure that that's going to help or hurt Professor Berman as he tries to move this case up, because this is we've already got the range here of 5 to 40 years. Judges, the fact finding already allows a sentence of up to 40 years, and that's, I think, going to be the difficult proposition for Professor Berman and the defense attorneys here. The range of the sentencing, the sentence that was imposed here was clearly within that range.
We've got one question pending. If you want to join the queue, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Our next question just dropped off the board. So now we've got two questions pending, however, so let's take our next question.
Yes, it's David Emerson, society member in Berkeley. The question for
Mr. Emerson, if you're on speakerphone, could you pick up? We're getting some background noise.
Yeah, let me see if I can do that.
Is that any better?
That's much better. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, this is David Emerson, society member in Berkeley. The question for both of the speakers has to do more with the difficult position that this puts the defense attorney in at trial, because it appears that there's apparently two trials going on at once. One is the obvious trial with the charges, and then there's a trial, the hidden trial to the judge at sentencing. And it's more goes to a question of, I guess, almost criminal due process and effective assistance of counsel, and just the limitations on what could be entered at trial. For example, if there's a charge which a defense attorney believes can be easily beaten, but which damning evidence is admitted by the prosecution, and there's no reason to defend against that because the defense attorney already believes they could win on that count, it puts the defense attorney in a difficult position to represent their client and yet at the same time expose their client to additional liability for undefended evidence later at sentencing. Your comments on that?
Well, I certainly, it merges with my more fundamental concern that placing some limits, in my view, ideally significant limits on judicial consideration of acquitted conduct at sentencing is important, much more so for limiting the power and leverage that prosecutors end up being advantaged from, being able to charge a particular crime, being able to give both the defense attorney and the defendant the challenge of having to think through all the different ways in which the proof could be coming forward to lead to a conviction, think about plea options and the like. And then, as you sort of suggest, if this and when this goes to trial, there's going to have to be an ongoing thought opportunity consideration of the need not just to convince a jury not to convict on a particular count, but to somehow undermine possible proof by a preponderance to a judge. Now, I will say, in terms of due process and others, my hope and expectation would be that in any such case, a defense attorney would be able to secure and a judge would provide a separate sentencing hearing, so that evidence that may not have been put forward in front of a jury could be put forward in front of the judge to try to undermine his finding by a preponderance, though I would like to correct one little point made by Professor Cassell, is though there's this assumption that Watts actually built on, that a preponderance standard is either constitutionally required or at least constitutionally sufficient proof for sentencing, that's actually never been so formally held. It's just the court approving sentencing statutes that make that the standard. And in fact, there are some settings in federal cases where we don't even have a formalistic finding to that effect. There's plenty of cases in the circuits that say something that has gone uncontested in a pre-sentence report can be sufficient basis for a sentence enhancement. And again, as this call highlights, defense attorneys and their clients may have a variety of challenging strategic reasons, not wanting to lose acceptance or responsibility credit, not wanting to open a can of worms that might disturb the client's interest long term, that undermine their ability procedurally to put forth a full case to try to limit the government's ability to get certain enhancements applied. Now, I'm inclined to say, and this is the challenge, that some process must be given as a matter of due process, and more often than not, sufficient process will be given to make it a fair fight. But whether it's a fair fight in light of what I would like to believe is our historic commitment to limiting government power rather than a tilted fight that means the government gets to try again until finally they convince somebody close enough that something happened that should justify extra punishment. And so, I hope Professor Cassell won't be surprised that I find moving those concerns, and their concerns that are, again, uniquely raised by the unique problem of acquitted conduct as the foundation for longer punishment in our federal system. Professor Cassell.
Professor Berman makes some good points. I guess the one thing I would alert him to, although obviously somebody, I'm sure he's thought of this before, but the point I want to alert him to in the context of this debate is be careful what you wish for. I mean, I think he is right that there hasn't been a square holding that preponderance of the evidence is appropriate standard of proof at sentencing. That's just been overassumed for, I think, well over 200 years. I think there's a well-developed line of at least practice that would support that approach. But we could certainly adopt different approaches, but I'm a little worried that if that's the rule then that's created to deal with the Antoine Ball situation, it might spill over into other areas that would not necessarily be useful even for defense attorneys. Let's remember the Antoine Ball case is an exceptional case. Only 2% of federal criminal cases go to trial, and within those that go to trial, the vast majority results in, you know, substantial guilty verdicts. So we're looking at a tiny, tiny fraction of cases, and if we craft rules that protect Antoine Ball, what would that look like in the more routine case? Let's say one of the 98% of all federal cases where the defendant pleads guilty and then argues that he's exceptionally remorseful, or that he's led a distinguished background, or that he has military service that ought to be taken into account. Are we then going to jack up the standard of proof at sentencing for those points as well as for the government's points? It seems to me that that might be the natural conclusion of an argument that we need to be more certain about the factors that are being relied upon at sentencing. Now, obviously, we could adopt a one-sided rule that says the government has to prove things by a 90% standard and the defendant only has to prove things by a 51% standard, but I don't think that the law would develop in that way. I think that that's one of the reasons that Congress has passed the statute 3661 that said there should be no limit on the kind of information that a judge can consider. They realize that in some cases that will work to the disadvantage of a defendant, but in many cases it'll work to the advantage of a defendant. And so this is, again, this curious world where Professor Berman is arguing for more strictures on judges, and I think I'm defending the proposition we should have fewer.
And I'll just put one last thought into that curious world, Professor Berman, responding in kind. I certainly agree, and that's why I enjoy this issue, because it creates certain curiosities. But Professor Cassell rightly points to the fact that 98% of federal criminal convictions are the product of pleas. And I encourage whatever one thinks about those statistics and what many judges and others lament as the vanishing jury trial, that a big driver for that may be the necessity of defense attorneys advising their clients after indictment, look, here's a multi-count indictment that alleges all sorts of stuff. Unless and until we can raise a reasonable doubt on every single charge here, even if you're acquitted, and I had a client like this in front of the 11th Circuit, even if you're acquitted on 98% of the charges, The 2% of the charges, which may be, relatively speaking, ticky-tack tax allegations. I don't know if I want to describe a sale of crack as a ticky-tack drug allegation, but even if it's the least serious of the charges that are in this indictment, given the broad statutory ranges that Congress generally attaches to all offenses and the fact that you may get punished through acquitted conduct enhancement, and in all likelihood the government's going to ask for you to be punished through acquitted conduct enhancement, even if you manage to win in getting an acquittal on 98% of the charges, why bother? Why not take the deal? And, of course, this is why prosecution likes this so much. They'd much rather have this resolved by a plea agreement, and they like the fact that they can threaten three bites at the apple to get you punished on that which the defendant believes he didn't do, or at least can raise questions about in front of a jury, that a jury concludes he didn't do, or at least concludes that the government didn't prove it sufficiently for their benefit, the defendant still gets punished on it. I find myself often having to saying in a defense role to my client, look, you might be better off falsely admitting to things you didn't do and getting the benefit that comes from that than actually exercising your right to trial, winning at trial, but ultimately being a long-term loser, not just in terms of the sentence you get in front of the judge, but also in what it's going to cost you to even get to that stage where you're still going to be facing down the barrel of pretty serious allegations that the government not only isn't going to back off, but going to be that much more intensely desirous of punishing you for because you made them lose at trial and didn't take a plea in the first instance.
We've got 2 minutes left. Let's see if we can get to this final question.
Hi, this is Vikrant Reddy with the Texas Public Policy Foundation and the Right on Crime campaign. I have two questions for Professor Berman that I think are basically directed at the likelihood of the court taking the case. The first is whether you detect any sympathy for your position from conservative members on the court. I'm thinking in particular of Justices Scalia and Thomas, who have written in ways in recent years that make me think they might be somewhat sympathetic to the position. What do you think?
I certainly hope so. I mean, one of the sad things about the Watts case, and I'm inclined to get conspiratorial about it in this setting, is not only was it decided per curiam, but it involved a reversal of the Ninth Circuit without oral argument. It was through a summary reversal process. And my fear is that had it been put up for full argument and full briefing, that both the public attention to the use of acquitted conduct as enhancement and the potential conservative arguments about limiting governing power might have changed the equation somewhat. And, you know, then Chief Justice Rehnquist was the author of the opinion. And again, it may be that when all is said and done, prosecutorial interests and government interests in this kind of setting, especially when we're dealing with a drug dealer, eclipse these kind of broader separation of powers or restrictions on prosecutorial power concerns. But especially in the wake of what Justice Scalia had to say and what Justice Thomas has also said, in a variety of Sixth Amendment cases when we're dealing with mandatory sentencing schemes, I'd like to believe they're open to the possibility, and that's one of the reasons we don't think it's, though, an uphill battle, a fruitless battle to see if the court will be interested.
Okay. Well, my second question, which may be partially already answered, is just that I'm interested in the fact that you're investing amicus time in this case. Do you think there's something about the particular facts of this case? I mean, I know that this case, or the issue, excuse me, has come up repeatedly. Judge Cassell mentioned in just about every other circuit, but is there something about the facts of this case that make you want to invest time in it?
Two things. I think the more recent decision in Allen A saying that mandatory minimums are also subject to the Sixth Amendment limitations of Apprendi, and especially a case called Pew, although that led to the usual liberal-conservative split, that said, for ex post facto problems, guideline calculations are still legally significant, and though the guidelines are advisory, they still have some constitutional import. Leads me to wonder whether, in the wake of those two recent rulings, there's at least an openness to reconsider Watts. And of course, Elaine is itself a reconsideration of the reach of the Sixth Amendment for mandatory minimum. So given that the court, partially because of new members, partially because of old members, rethinking some of these issues in light of new precedents, we're at least hopeful, but I will be very candid and say I'm not especially optimistic.
Professor Cassell, a final thought.
Yeah, I think maybe we can end on a note, I think, of agreement. I think Professor Berman is right to flag this case as one that could present an interesting issue for the court, but they've seemed to be focused on circuit splits almost exclusively as a basis for taking cases up now. And since there's such unanimity among the lower courts, I think it really is quite an uphill battle.
Well, I think we're going to have to leave it there. Today, my thanks, of course, to Professors Douglas Berman and Paul Cassell. It's certainly an interesting exchange. Nice to have a diversity of opinion here on the phone today with us. And to our audience, next week we have telephone conference calls scheduled each day. Monday we'll be talking about the FTC versus Wyndham case. On Tuesday it's the Susan B. Anthony List case. Wednesday is the Argentina bond case. All three of those are argued in the Supreme Court next week. Thursday we'll be talking about encryption. And Friday, IQ, mental capacity, and the death penalty. So check our website for more information and exact times on those calls. But until our next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.